We'd like to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. The title of this session is Mormon Motherhood, Choice or Destiny. My name is Janice Allred. This session is sponsored by the Mormon Women's Forum, and I am the president of that organization. Before we get into our panel, I would like to announce to you another conference, the Mormon Women's Forum Annual Counterpoint Conference. And if you look on page 34 of your program, we have a little ad about the conference. The date is October 18th. It will be from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is on a Saturday in the Open Student Union at the University of Utah. The theme is Gender in Our Lives. And the format this year is going to be a little bit different. We're going to be concentrating on discussion and participation. So we will have a moderator or leader who will lead a discussion on each of these different topics that are listed in here. So we hope that you will join us for this conference. Now, if I can find back where I was before. Now I will introduce to you our panel members, and then our basic format will be I'm going to do an introduction, and then each of the panel members will give their presentations. And then we should have some time for audience questions, participation, and discussion. Our panel members are Lori Winder Stromer. We only have Lori Winder in here. Sorry, Lori. Lori Winder Stromberg. She has an MA in humanities. She's the former editor of the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly. Margaret Toscano has a PhD in classics. She is an assistant professor of classics at the University of Utah.
We can't hear you.
Oh, okay.
Is it on?
Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not on? Can someone with technical ability assist me? It's on. I'm just not doing a good job. Okay, I will stand right here. I'm not going to repeat the introductions. Look in your program. That's where I'm reading them from. Emily Benton. Oh, I wasn't finished with Margaret. Margaret has written a number of articles on feminist and theological topics. Her latest one that you may have read about are boys more important than girls? Our next panelist is Emily Benton. Emily Benton is an Arizona native. She has recently repatriated to the desert after living for 5 years in Salt Lake City, where she enjoyed writing and editing during her employment at Design Workshop. She received her undergraduate degree in English from BYU, and she plans to attend graduate school in Arizona after she reestablishes residency. Our last panelist is Janet Gerard Willis. She is a doctoral candidate in literature at St. Louis University. She's a blogger, and she's a blogger on the feminist Mormon housewives. So those are our panel participants. I listen carefully to every session of General Conference to prepare for my role as the moderator of the Mormon Alliance's conference critique. I'm particularly interested in what the two women speakers have to say. Julie Beck, the new president of the General Relief Society, spoke in the Sunday morning session of the October 2007 conference. As I listened to her talk about mothers and the important work they do, urging women to magnify this calling, I thought, there will be trouble. But the storm of protest that followed surprised even me. Beck's talk was widely interpreted as a call for LDS women to devote themselves to the traditional role of motherhood. There have been some indications that the church is becoming more accepting of the changes in women's roles and parenting arrangements that have taken place in the larger society. So the talk was unexpected and disappointing. Once again, women felt that they were being handed a script for their lives that they couldn't follow. A press conference was held between the two Sunday sessions of the April 2008 General Conference for the new Young Women's Presidency. Elaine Dalton, the new president, was asked how they were planning to address the problem of inactivity among young women. The reporter cited a statistic that indicated as many as 80% of the single Mormon women between 18 and 30 were no longer active in the LDS Church. The statistic shocked me. I knew that the inactivity rate was high for young women, but this indicated a real crisis. Dalton didn't question or downplay the statistic. Her response indicated that she was well aware of it. She replied that she and her counselors planned to, quote, reach out and strengthen those young women to help them understand who they are and the divine mission they have on earth. I thought, maybe that's the problem. The church has no definition of the divine mission of a single woman. The ideas presented by Beck in her talk gave concrete expression to the gender role specified for women in the church's proclamation on the family. Officially titled The Family, A Proclamation to the World, it was presented to the church by President Hinckley at the General Relief Society meeting on September 23, 1995. Although the ideas expressed in it had been widely taught by church leaders for many years, it gives a succinct, authoritative statement of the church's position on issues of gender and sexuality. It gives a doctrinal basis for the church's stand on gender, gender roles, family, sexual morality, and marriage. Although it doesn't mention homosexuality, this omission means that homosexuality has no place in the eternal family. It sets up, sanctions, and legitimizes a hierarchical, authoritarian, patriarchal system and gives it a cosmological significance. What is the doctrinal status of the proclamation? A proclamation has no official doctrinal status. The proclamation on the family does not claim to be a revelation. Although it was issued by the First Presidency and Council of the Twelve Apostles, it is reported to have been written by a committee over a period of several years. Nevertheless, although it hasn't been officially canonized, most members accept it as church doctrine, binding upon them as church members. It is regularly referred to as the authoritative source for teachings about the eternal family in wards, stakes, and in general conference. Many members have framed copies hanging on the walls of their homes. In its view of God and humanity, the proclamation on the family defines a patriarchal cosmos. This cosmos is, I believe, fundamentally contradictory to that of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is, I think, significant that a document proclaimed by the First Presidency and 12 apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints gives a view of a cosmos in which Jesus Christ is not even mentioned, except as one whose teachings will promote happiness in family life. The gospel of Jesus Christ addresses all human beings as individuals, as persons of equal worth. Christ's love for each individual is unconditional. He inviteth all to come unto him and partake of his goodness, and he denieth none who come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. And he remembereth the heathen, and all are alike unto God. The proclamation defines the family as the fundamental unit of society, and by implication, the fundamental unit of the cosmos. If the family, not the person, is the fundamental unit of society, the person does not exist independently of the family, and a person does not have intrinsic worth. He or she only has value in his or her role within the family. Indeed, in this view, since the individual is part of the family, and the family is the fundamental unit, the individual is her role. Roles are inherently unequal, and if there is no distinction between role and person, people only have utilitarian value. They are of value only if they fulfill their roles, and unconditional love is meaningless. Not only are persons identified with their roles in the proclamation, but roles are identified with gender, and gender is identified with sex. The proclamation states that the father's eternal role, given by divine design, is to preside over his family, to provide them with resources, and protect them. The mother's role is to nurture her children. The roles assigned to man essentially define personhood, making decisions, controlling resources, and having power, while the role assigned to women is a sacrificial role. Is motherhood a choice, or is it a woman's destiny? According to the proclamation, each person is a beloved spirit, son or daughter of heavenly parents, and as such, each has a divine nature and destiny. Purporting to define the nature of cosmological righteousness, the proclamation gives a woman only one role, that of nurturing her children. A single woman exists in the proclamation only as a daughter of heavenly parents, waiting to fulfill her destiny. To nurture means to nourish with that which is necessary to sustain life and development, to give to sacrifice for. But giving and sacrifice must be voluntary, and they must be done from and with love to be true sacrifice and fully efficacious. Motherhood is a role, a good role and a necessary role, but a good mother must first be a person, and she must continue to be a person with desires, needs, and goals outside of her role as a mother. The absence of the Heavenly Mother in the proclamation illustrates the disappearance of someone defined simply as a role. Anne Crittenden, in her important book, The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is the Least Valued, asserts that motherhood is the most important job in the world. She says, in the modern economy, 2/3 of all wealth is created by human skills, creativity, and enterprise, what is known as human capital. And that means parents who are conscientiously and effectively rearing children are literally, in the words of economist Shirley Burggraf, the major wealth producers in our society. She continues, but this very material contribution is still considered immaterial. All the lip service to motherhood still floats in the air as insubstantial as clouds of angel dust. On the ground where mothers live, the lack of respect and tangible recognition is still part of every mother's experience. I think one reason that women become so upset when they hear talks like Beck's is that although they are working as hard as they can, there are many things they would like to do that they can't, and many things that they are doing that they would like to do better. We tend to see the problem of juggling family, work, and personal development, not to mention recreation and sleeping, as a purely personal problem. But there are many things that government, businesses, churches, and families could do to ease the burdens of mothers and all caregivers. Crittenden writes, it isn't fair that mothers' life-sustaining work forces women to be society's involuntary philanthropists. It isn't fair to expect mothers to make sacrifices that no one else is asked to make or have virtues no one else possesses, such as a dignified subordination of their personal agenda and a reliance on altruism for life's meaning. Virtues and sacrifices, when expected of one group of people and not of everyone, become the mark of an underclass. Every society, every organization, every family, every group needs nurturers and caregivers, people who are willing to do the work that needs to be done, to pick up the slack, to do the jobs that aren't on the charts, to look after the emotional, spiritual, and physical health of the people they love. When my oldest daughter went to college at BYU, she lived in an apartment with some friends. She often came home to our house in Provo for Sunday dinner, and one day she told me that she and her roommates had worked out a plan for keeping things in order. They divided up the jobs, made a chart, and gave everyone her assignments. But, Rebecca told me with a puzzled expression, even when we all do all our jobs, the place is a mess. Later, when we were eating, she said to her brothers and sister, you guys have no idea what mommy does. She now has 6 children, and she has a pretty good idea. My cell phone rang yesterday morning. Half asleep, I answered it. The voice on the other end was high pitched and unintelligible. Hello, I said. Hello? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. And then I thought, it must be John, my brother, using yet another of his silly voices. You, I stated emphatically, are such a freak. The response, a wailed, Mom! My normally even-keeled happy daughter was sobbing. She called me for solace, and I offered, you are such a freak. This is also the child who gazed up at me when she was 10 or 11 and said, Mom, I just can't imagine you the mother of small children. And now my authoritative remarks on motherhood. I suppose no discussion of motherhood in a Judeo-Christian context is complete without some reference to Mother Eve. But which Eve? The Pandora's box Eve of traditional Christianity? The seeker of knowledge and the power that comes with it who, in seeking, brought death and condemnation on us all? Or the second Eve, the Eve of the Middle Ages, Mary, the mother of Jesus, who by the end of the 12th century redeemed us all through her role as co-redemptrix with Christ, at least in some of the theological literature of the time. Or rather, the schizophrenic Mormon Eve, who, yes, chose wisely, or did she? Who committed the first sin, or was it a transgression? But in so doing, chose a necessary evil that men might be and ultimately have joy. The Eve who took the lead and suffered subjugation for it. It might be apparent from the discussion above that I feel a tad ambivalent about Mother Eve, or rather about the way she's been used in theological debates, and about motherhood. For the record, I love my children, and I'm proud of the people they are becoming. Part of my ambivalence might be colored by my experience with my own mother. When Mom died a few years ago, in some ways I found myself mourning the mother I wished I'd had, rather than the mother I had. But how fair is this? I'm a relatively reasonable, ethical, functioning adult with strong ties to friends and family. Had I been set up by society, by religion, by Mormonism to expect too much? Have we all, and at what price? I've titled my remarks, "The Angel and the Bitch," thoughts on motherhood and power. Because I want to explore my ambivalence about the role of motherhood and how it intersects with power. The first part of my title references an extended Victorian poem, "The Angel in the House," which I couldn't make myself read in its entirety, sentimental canto after sentimental canto after sentimental canto. Suffice it to say, the image of the angel mother in the house has its roots in the notion of separate spheres for men and women that was codified, indeed fetishized, during the Victorian era. I say fetishized because historians are now challenging the idea that the ideology of separate spheres, quote, in which men were to be breadwinners and active in the public sphere while women were to be homemakers confined to the private sphere, were as rigid and uncontested as once thought, particularly when one examines class and race. Were these spheres then, are they now, a romanticized illusion? That many think they are is evidenced by a book my title also references called "The Bitch in the House," an obvious parody on the poem described above, in which 26 women tell the truth about sex, solitude, work, motherhood, and marriage, edited by Kathy Hanauer. Parenthetically, a companion book edited by Hanauer's husband, Daniel Jones, is titled "The Bastard on the Couch." 27 men try really hard to explain their feelings about love, loss, fatherhood, and freedom. Both Mike Quinn and Sonia Farnsworth have suggested that when the LDS Church publicly renounced polygamy and emerged from isolation at the turn of the 20th century, it adopted prevailing Victorian values with a vengeance and tenaciously holds on to them. According to Quinn, just as the cult of the new woman as domestic keeper of culture and virtue arose in reaction to the economic and social upheaval of Victorian England, so too the cult of motherhood in the LDS Church was further punctuated in response to the social upheaval of the 1960s generally and the women's movement more particularly. That the LDS Church continues to promote separate spheres for men and women is evident in countless talks by church leaders, both male and female, documents such as the Family, A Proclamation to the World, and our all-male priesthood policy. Let me offer a few examples. In The Role of Righteous Women, delivered in the 1979 Women's Fireside, President Spencer W. Kimball begins by asserting the full equality of God's spirit children, end quote. Quoting from John A. Woodsow, he asserts, quote, "The place of women in the church is to walk beside the man, not in front of him. In the church, there is full equality between man and woman." He then continues, "Within these great assurances, however, our roles and assignments differ. There are eternal differences, with women being given many tremendous responsibilities of motherhood and sisterhood, and men being given the tremendous responsibilities of fatherhood and priesthood." Addressing the role of women a little less delicately, then Apostle Ezra Taft Benson, in his remarks titled "The Honored Place of Woman," delivered at the 1981 General Women's Meeting, said, and I'm quoting from him extensively, "In the beginning, God placed woman in a companion role with the priesthood.
woman was given to man as a helpmeet. That complementary association is ideally portrayed in the eternal marriage of our first parents, Adam and Eve. Before the world was created, in heavenly councils, the pattern and role of women were prescribed. You were elected by God to be wives and mothers in Zion. Exaltation in the celestial kingdom is predicated on faithfulness to that calling. Since the beginning, a woman's first and most important role has been ushering into mortality spirit sons and daughters of our Heavenly Father. Note the absence of any reference to a mother in heaven. In the beginning, Adam was instructed to earn the bread by the sweat of his brow, not Eve. Contrary to conventional wisdom, a mother's place is in the home! Exclamation point. It is a misguided idea that a woman should leave the home where there is a husband and children to prepare educationally and financially for an unforeseen eventuality. Unquote. The proclamation on the family prescribes the duties associated with the separate spheres of Mormon men and women in this way. By divine design, fathers are to preside over their families in love and righteousness and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. In these sacred responsibilities, fathers and mothers are obligated to help one another as equal partners. While Benson makes no explicit references to the parity of men's and women's spheres, both Kimball and the proclamation offer a separate but equal view of their defined roles. However, several obvious questions emerge from such rhetoric. Wasn't the notion of separate but equal ruled untenable in a secular setting? How, then, is it not untenable in a religious setting? Is it logically possible for men to take the presiding role and still function in an equal partnership with women? Doesn't the act of presiding by its very nature undercut an equitable relationship, no matter how benevolent? As Margaret Toscano has suggested, no matter how much lip service is given to women's worth and equality, the patriarchal governing structure of the church gives dominance and preference to men and their views, simply because they have the say as to how things are organized and defined. Unquote. The assumption is made in much of church discourse on the roles of men and women, quoting from Margaret again, that men have the right, as well as the ability, to define women's roles, to determine whether or not women's condition is fair or unfair, and to establish the environment in which they can find happiness, unquote. Returning to our foundational creation myth, God, it is written, gave Adam the power to name the animals, the plants, even Eve, and in so doing, the power to define, to circumscribe, to prescribe. Now let's look more specifically at the rhetoric of motherhood. In his April 1999 conference talk, The Message Next to the Angels, Apostle Russell M. Nelson quotes from a First Presidency statement made years earlier. Quote, motherhood is near to divinity. Listen carefully. It is the highest, holiest service to be assumed by mankind. It places her who honors its holy calling and service next to the angels, unquote. Perhaps we've descended a bit from the angel in the house, but you get the point. To be fair, the exalted rhetoric of motherhood is not ours alone. In the mommy myth, the idealization of motherhood and how it has undermined women, authors Susan J. Douglas and Meredith W. Michaels write, I'm quoting from them, if you're like us, mothers with an attitude problem, you may be getting increasingly irritable about this chasm between the ridiculous honey-hued ideals of perfect motherhood and the reality of mothers' everyday lives. The love we feel for our kids, the joyful times we have with them, are repackaged into unattainable images of infinite patience and constant adoration so that we fear, as Kristen Ogtrop put it movingly in The Bitch in the House, I will love my children, but my love for them will always be imperfect. Like increasing numbers of women, we are fed up with the myth that motherhood is eternally fulfilling and rewarding, that it is always the best and most important thing you do, and that there is only a narrowly prescribed way to do it right, and that if you don't love each and every second of it, there's something really wrong with you. Quote. Douglas and Michaels continue by describing what they call momism, the insistence that no woman is truly complete or fulfilled unless she has kids, that women remain the best primary caretakers of children, and that to be a remotely decent mother, a woman has to devote her entire physical, psychological, emotional, and intellectual being 24/7 to her children. Momism is a highly romanticized and yet demanding view of motherhood in which the standards for success are impossible to meet. Unquote. The Victorians saw marriage and motherhood, in the words of W.R. Gregg, as unmistakably indicated as the despotic law of life. Perhaps it is not motherhood per se, but the despotism in the way it has been defined and circumscribed that troubles many of us. The mismatch described above between expectation and experience is exacerbated in the church by the fact that motherhood is prescribed essentially as the only role for women, forever. Nowhere is this concept more stark than in Sherry L. Dew's 2001 General Relief Society meeting talk, Are We Not All Mothers? Dew, a single professional woman speaking to an audience of women, asks, and I quote from her, "Have you wondered why prophets have taught the doctrine of motherhood? And it is a doctrine, again and again. When we understand the magnitude of motherhood, it becomes clear why prophets have been so protective of women's most sacred role. While we tend to equate motherhood solely with maternity, in the Lord's language, the word mother has layers of meaning. Of all the words they could have chosen to define her role and her essence, both God the Father and Adam called Eve the mother of all living. And they did so before she ever bore a child. Like Eve, our motherhood began before we were born. Just as worthy men were foreordained to hold the priesthood in mortality, righteous women were endowed premortally with the privilege of motherhood. Motherhood is more than bearing children, though it is certainly that. It is the essence of who we are as women. It defines our very identity, our divine stature and nature, and the unique traits our Father gave us." Unquote. Could there possibly be some unexplored reasons for the Church's insistent rhetoric on motherhood? I think there might be. With the rise of the feminist movement and the demand for gender equity, the pairing of priesthood for men and with motherhood for women, though not new, became more pronounced in church discourse. Aside from the difficulty of giving up their position of privilege, is it possible that men, when confronted with the inequity of an all-male priesthood, had trouble facing it? Kimball recognized in his words quoted above that fatherhood is the parallel to motherhood. Unfortunately, he failed to see that brotherhood is the parallel to sisterhood, and that priesthood, with its attendant right, in Bruce Hafen's words, quote, "to administer the gospel and govern all things," has no parallel for women. Is the rhetoric of motherhood bloated, as Sonia Farnsworth has suggested, in order to, quote, "distract us from the limitations and vulnerabilities women accept if they devote themselves exclusively to domesticity," unquote, and, as I believe, to mask our institutional powerlessness outside that sphere? It's interesting to note that in her much-debated October conference talk, Mothers Who Know, General Relief Society President Julie Beck used the term power associated with women at least 7 times. The problem is the talk was unbelievably retro, even reactionary in its perceived insistence that the only acceptable use of power by women is as mothers and homemakers. Given the many examples of similar rhetoric quoted above, why then did a fair number of mainstream LDS women, let alone those with feminist leanings, respond particularly to Beck's talk, not just in whispers in the foyer, but on public blogs and more dramatically by launching a website, What Women Know, to offer a more expansive and nuanced perspective on women's lives, aspirations, and experience? As General Relief Society President, Beck is in many ways our only voice within the patriarchal structure of the church, which means that the weight falls on her to accurately represent our experience. I'd like to believe the reaction to her talk indicates that a growing number of LDS women are beginning to recognize that there might be an uncomfortable gap between Beck's narrow, prescriptive rhetoric and their experience, particularly as the sphere of women's influence expands in the secular world. When I was pregnant with my daughter, Lizzie, I bought a She-Ra Princess of Power book for my son, Stephen. He immediately started referring to Lizzie as She-Ra. When she was born, he informed his class that he had a new baby sister and that her name was Elizabeth. But he called her She-Ra, Princess of Power. He then paused and added, "She-Ra's not as powerful as we'd hoped." Alas, if Beck's talk is any indication, after years of feminist activism, institutionally, neither are we.
Why did Julie Beck's talk, Mothers Who Know, raise such a stir last fall? For that matter, why does the word motherhood so often get women riled up, whether they are mothers or not, whether they are married, single, or divorced, and whether they are young or old? On one level, Beck's talk was merely a reiteration of the church's current position on motherhood as women's primary role, as stated in the 1995 Proclamation on the Family, which is a reflection of statements made by male church leaders from the 19th century on, as Laurie has indicated. In some ways, Sister Beck merely states what President Hinckley asserted in his 2004 talk on women's worth and what Apostle Russell Ballard said in his April 2008 talk, so that was after Beck's talk, which in fact seemed to have been a response to the protest against her talk. Both Hinckley and Ballard reinforced the proclamation to the family by focusing on mothering as women's most important role. And yet Beck was highly criticized, while Hinckley and Ballard were both applauded. Why? When I asked Lori about this last week, she said there were two reasons, which she has stated again today. First, because Julie Beck's talk was so retro, and second, because as the Relief Society president, she is the official voice for women. If Sister Beck doesn't speak out for women in the church, who will? Evidently, some male leaders do a better job than women like Julie Beck and Sherry do. Beck's talk, when you examine it, is both more retro and concedes less to women who don't follow the conventional path set out for them than either President Hinckley or Brother Ballard. The language in her talk that was most disturbing conjured up images of perfect moms from the TV sitcoms of the 1950s, but decked out in a new church dress. Just barely new, though. Beck equates teaching children about sacred ordinances and covenants with mothers making sure their sons and daughters are immaculately and conservatively groomed for church meetings. She equates nurturing with homemaking and homemaking with cooking, washing clothes and dishes, keeping an orderly home. Her tone feels almost militant, as though there is only one righteous way to approach mothering. So it is indeed disturbing when Brother Ballard shows more understanding for the diversity of women's lives and more sympathy for the difficulties of motherhood than Sister Beck. Even though he has never been a mother, he says, quote, "There is no one perfect way to be a good mother. Each situation is unique." He acknowledges that many women either have to work outside the home or may want to at some period of their lives. He stresses that the most important thing is that a mother loves her children deeply and prioritizes them above all else. He acknowledges how frustrating mother can be, especially when children are young. He encourages mothers to find time for themselves and cultivate their gifts and interests. And he ends by praying that God will continually bless the women of the church to find joy and happiness in their sacred roles as daughters of God. I agree with Lori that Beck's talk caused a stir because of the way she emphasized mothering as women's primary role. However, I worry about the fact that there has been so little reaction against the same basic assumptions in the talks by Hinckley and Ballard. It is true that these men's talks give women more latitude and encouragement, but it is so paltry, really, when compared to the church's doctrinal stance on women's eternal place. The bottom line is the same. Women's primary role is nurturing through motherhood, whereas men provide, preside, and protect, as Janice has explained. Ballard shows this when he describes how husbands can support their wives in their roles, and Hinckley shows this in the way he emphasizes priesthood structures. I worry that sympathetic language can blind us to the deeper systemic problems that undergird the motherhood language. I worry that we are so used to categories about motherhood and priesthood that they have become normalized and therefore nothing to react against. And of course, some of us have gotten quite weary when our protests seem to make no difference. For this reason, I am actually grateful for Julie Beck's talk. It woke people up. It made people talk more about this important topic on the internet than they have in quite some time. It created an activist website, What Women Know, that Lori referred to, where both men and women actually signed their real names in protest. But I don't think personally that we have reacted strongly enough against the motherhood rhetoric in the church, especially as it relates to women's spiritual roles and personhood within the church structure. And I think that there are some areas that we haven't explored enough. Certainly, we don't have time to do that today, but I want to make a few suggestions of things that we might think about. The first relates to Julie Beck's talk again. In patriarchal systems, women are used as the chief instruments for keeping other women in line, and they usually do it voluntarily. It is not simply for privacy issues that women are the ones who usually perform clitorectomies on other women. Women have something to gain by reinforcing proper female behavior because patriarchy gives very real benefits and protection to women who play by its roles. This often encourages women to compete for the approval of men, which means women will often see other women as their chief antagonists, not men. In a 2005 Sunstone article about rivalry in women's relationships, Julie Montier Hawker states, quote, I have rarely, if ever, felt oppressed by men in the church because of its patriarchal nature. I have consistently felt disapproval from some LDS women as I strive to carve out my individual role, end quote. I believe what Julie says is true, but I'm also concerned about her failure to see the way the patriarchal system plays into this kind of conflict among women. By this, I do not mean that individual men are the problem. I know just as many good men as women who are disturbed by inequity. I am saying that it is the system itself that creates problems, and that we too often focus on individual people, women or men, rather than critiquing the underlying system. And I think this happened with Beck's talk. Second, I worry that the public reaction to Beck's talk reflects another reality about a patriarchal system, namely that it is more acceptable to question a woman's authority than a man's in the church. While bloggers who criticized Beck's talk were themselves criticized by countless others on various LDS blogs for challenging a leader of the church, still criticizing a woman leader is not as bad as criticizing the prophet or one of the 12. Besides, would Beck have been seen as too feminist if she had conceded more to women in her talk? Do women have to be more obedient, more retro, in order not to be seen as a threat? I am not justifying Beck's stance, but simply pointing to the fact that the issue of motherhood is more loaded for women when they talk about it than men. And I'm not saying that we should all agree in one united sisterhood in this issue, but still, we have a lot in common that we could work toward. This brings me to my third point, which is an extension of the first. I am very disturbed that women are pitted against women in the battlehood about motherhood. Just the fact that the battle metaphor is so commonly used is troubling. It's even called the mommy wars. Working women are pitted against stay-at-home moms, women without children against those who have them, high-profile career women versus low-paid wage earners, feminists versus traditional women. And unfortunately, in LDS rhetoric, it's often Mormon women who know the truth about motherhood versus secular women who are ruining the family. And yet my interaction with women, both in academia and other professions across the country, as well as just listening to TV, like I like to do, indicates to me that most women want to be good mothers and care deeply about the family. My female colleagues at the University of Utah with children also struggle to balance home and career. They are just as dedicated as LDS women to the proper nurturing of their children. And anyone who does even a cursory search of books on the topic of motherhood on Amazon or other sites sees what an issue it is. Janice and Lori have both made references to books that I won't reiterate. So with so many women concerned about being good mothers, and I think we truly are, why so much rhetoric about the failure of mothering? Why are women blamed and mothers blamed for so many societal problems? Certainly, I don't have the definitive answer. But again, I think we need to look at larger systems, societal shifts, and the need to find scapegoats. One disturbing aspect of the mommy wars is that it makes us all defensive. We have to defend our love for our children if we work outside the home. We have to defend our intelligence and competence if we stay at home. Most of us feel guilty on some level. Even those of us who have rejected the supermom image long ago find themselves trying to live up to it. I keep wondering why I do. And finally, last year, I admitted to myself that I will never be a good housekeeper. Not only can't I keep everything clean all the time, I can't even keep some things clean some of the time. I am one of those who worked after my children were born simply because I love teaching and academia. When my children were small, it would have been more economically advantageous if I hadn't taught, even though I only did it part-time because I wanted to be with my daughters more. In an ironic reversal that I didn't see coming, now my employment is an enormous economic advantage to my family because I have good health care and retirement, whereas Paul, who is self-employed, has none. We would have been bankrupt by two major surgeries in the last 5 years if it weren't for my job. Still, I have made enormous sacrifices in both my career and at home in order to balance them. It took me 14 years to finish my PhD. Sometimes I have felt like I have failed at both. They have both brought me enormous satisfaction and frustration. And just when things were easing up, my youngest daughter had a baby and moved back home as a single mom. Our little granddaughter, Maggie, tears at my heart. I bear a lot of responsibility for her care. I don't think my struggles are atypical, though. I know that I am very privileged to have had the choice about whether to work when my children were young. My last few points all center on the question of personhood and identity, which I think are vital to discuss, as Janice mentioned. The most troubling aspect of the LDS motherhood rhetoric, as indicated not just by Beck's talk, but by the men's talks too, is the damage it does to all women's identities, whether they have children or not. Almost the only role held up for women to emulate is motherhood, forever and ever and ever, as Lori says. In this context, it can sound like a prison term, even if you like being a mother. I agree with the What Women Know proclamation that nurture is about peacefulness and care, universal attributes that both men and women should acquire to be good stewards of the earth. But to be told that nurturing is my one primary duty, implying I am wrong to aspire to others, feels so confining, so out of context with the doctrine of eternal progression. As mentioned, Brother Ballard ends his talk with the prayer that LDS women may find happiness in their sacred roles as daughters of God. I don't want to take away from the real inspiration of his sentiment, which I believe can encourage women to see themselves in expansive ways. But daughters of God, not even daughters of heavenly parents or heavenly mother, emphasizes women's ancillary status. What would it be like to hear phrases like women's sacred roles as priestesses of God, or their sacred roles as healers or revelators or prophetesses, their sacred roles as poets, teachers, scholars, whatever might emphasize a diversity of roles and spiritual power? Women's motherhood role in the church is almost always juxtaposed with men's priesthood role. This false equation takes away from women's spiritual contribution to the church at large, and it adds another layer of guilt to women's already overburdened consciences. Beck's talk suggests that if we find influence and power outside the realm of mothering in the home, then we are on the wrong track. And yet women do have an influence on the larger church because of their service, which is often satisfying to them. They don't have as much power as they should have, in my opinion, like Shira, but they do exercise a little in the public arena, even in the church. One of the most damaging aspects of the motherhood rhetoric is that it covers over women's lack of influence in the church. It makes us believe this is God's will, when I see no doctrinal or moral reason why it should be. All recent talks given about women's roles in the church emphasize the phrase equal partners from the Proclamation on the Family. I believe this phrase is deeply deceptive. At the same time, I do want to acknowledge that many couples in the church are striving to make this a reality, in spite of the church's structure that I think works against it. Equal partners is a deceptive phrase because it makes it seem as though Mormon women are fully equal if they are equal partners with men in the home, even if they are not equal in the public arena. And yet men having priesthood and the roles of presiding, providing, and protecting all work against equality in the home too. Dallin Oaks admitted in a 2005 conference talk that the concept of equal partners only applies to the home and not to the church structure. On one level, this is obvious, but on another, it is an appalling admission, since it reveals the hollowness of the priesthood, the motherhood-priesthood dichotomy as equal. If motherhood were really the equivalent of priesthood, then its influence would not be confined to the home. If mothers are so vital, where is the council of mothers, either in heaven or on earth, to promote nurture and care and right relationship at every level of the church and in the world at large? If the church really cared about motherhood, they would put their money where their mouth is. Councils of women in the church who had real authority and resources could think of many creative ways of helping mothers with their most pressing problems, which they themselves could identify. For years, women have been saying that LDS chapels that stand empty during the week would be great places for daycare. No family can survive without quality childcare, whether the mother works outside the home or not. If the church just took all the resources it is using to fight against the legalization of gay marriage, there would be plenty of time and money to help mothers and children. Gay marriage, in my opinion, is not a threat to the family, but poverty is. No child in the church should be without health insurance. There are plenty of financial wizards in the church who could come up with creative corporate solutions. If we still believed in the principles of Zion, we would band together to make sure that mothers who desired could stay home with their children during their early years. We could at least ensure a six-month leave. Gay marriage is not a threat to the family, but isolation and depression are. Mothers need places where they can take children for activities and interaction with other children. With increasing gas prices and economic crunches, local chapels would be perfect places where mothers could meet to chat while their children played together. The only suggestion Brother Ballard had for helping young mothers was leaders being sensitive about giving them too many callings. How about asking women what they need? They are intelligent and inventive. Gay marriage is not a threat to the family, but violence and war profiteering are. Why hasn't the church mustered its resources to speak out more against war? Obviously, this motherhood rhetoric makes me a little upset. But I also think that other Mormon women should be equally as upset as I am, and I want to know why they're not. I think we need more protest, because the bottom line is this. The motherhood rhetoric is not at all about the valuing of mothers. If it were, the Heavenly Mother would be more visible. The motherhood is near to divinity slogan that Russell Nelson spouted in his 1999 talk is simply manipulative. How near to divinity? Not near enough, in my opinion. Motherhood has no divinity if Heavenly Mother is not an equal partner in the creation and salvation of the world. Motherhood is useless if the Heavenly Mother is not directly involved in our lives. I believe in paradox, that self-discovery is a lifelong, even eternal task that pushes beyond simple dichotomies, formulas, or roles. Power can be dangerous, but it's important because it's a principle of action. In giving it up, I may find it. My worth is more than even my identity as a daughter of a Heavenly Mother and Father. God says, I am that I am. What an intriguing self-description. I am worthwhile because I am alive now and eternally. I have often thought how silly it is that I should give up all of my personal dreams for learning and achieving so that I can mother daughters who will give up what they want to mother daughters who will give up what they want in some endless chain where all that is achieved is the perpetuation of a mindless human race. I like the line from the What Women Know proclamation. Quote, the life story we are ultimately responsible for is our own. It is not just that I am more than my roles as mother, wife, sister, daughter, friend, teacher, scholar, or countless other roles. The truth is that I am more than anything I do or achieve or say or believe or even know about myself. Because our souls are eternal, our identities are ever unfolding in ways that we choose, but often don't choose or even understand. And the beauty and excitement of the journey is in that process of discovering and becoming and desiring. Thy power, desire is dangerous, but so necessary to development. I fear Mormon women and men are afraid to desire what is not prescribed. What I resist most about rigid roles and formulas of behavior is that they stop us from desiring, from longing for the unknown, from seeking the mysteries within our own hearts, and from exploring our complex relationship to the wide expanse of the universe of which we are a living and changing part. Thank you.
Great if we could add Margaret's conclusion to the young woman's theme. In a recent episode of This American Life, Ira Glass said, "We live in an age of maps that ignore everything in the world but one thing. These maps have meaning because they filter out all the chaos in the world and focus obsessively on one item." The program got me thinking about how our lives are mapped out for us in the church. We are not only encouraged, but expected to go through certain milestones. For men, some of the scheduled stops are baptism, priesthood, temple, mission, education, marriage, career, children, and if they live long enough, the high priest group. For women, it's baptism, education, optional, mission, optional, temple, marriage, children, grandchildren, and if they live long enough, great-grandchildren. The roadmap revolves around motherhood. As all maps are limited and focused on one aspect of geography, so too the Mormon map for women is limited and can sometimes leave you feeling lost. Initially, when I heard about the 80% quote, I thought it was probably a bit of an exaggeration. So I decided to have an informal discussion with several young LDS women of varying states of marital status and church activity, some of whom are here today. Most have spent some time on the less active list, Some have always been staunchly active, and some have left the church entirely. Here's a sampling of what they had to say. It can feel like a kick in the teeth when folks talk about people being single until the Lord feels they are ready. It's tough for me to look around at a room full of 20-year-old college dropouts who are wearing wedding rings and think that somehow I'm still single because I'm not as advanced as they are. Another said, being a single female in the LDS church is just a tightrope walk, no matter who you are and what you want. Another woman remarked, so little depends on a woman's own spiritual development. Rather, those roles are mainly based on circumstances that are rarely available to everyone because of a variety of realities, divorce, infertility, gender confusion, singlehood, etc. And another said, I've struggled for some time with inactivity for varying reasons, though a lot of it came down to feeling like I didn't belong in a singles ward or in a family ward. What bothers me is hearing how much my mom is worried about me because I haven't married and procreated like my younger sisters have, and that somehow my success in my career is less worthy of her accolades because my success isn't a grandchild. And finally, our resident Relief Society president commented, the older I became, who just recently got married, I felt less and less connected to the gospel and the business of going to church. I felt like I was stepping deeper and deeper into a sect of membership that wasn't the most desirable to be in. I always had a real sense that there wasn't really a place for me, that no one, church leadership, really knew what to do with me. And I had a lot of angst along the lines of, why is it that I've been chosen to have this particular trial in my life? The trial that is being single in the Mormon church. And what keeps me going to church, besides my testimony, which is strong sometimes and not so strong on an ever-changing basis, is the hope that I can remind the people in my ward, and maybe even more specifically the single sisters, that they absolutely have a place to be, and try to validate whatever path we all end up on, because we can't always pick. Maps are an image of reality, but not reality itself. There are a lot of ways to map out a life. I've had a few course corrections myself. Despite my feminist upbringing and academic focus, as a young woman, I secretly viewed going to college as an opportunity to find a husband and have babies. I rarely, if ever, thought about a serious career. Education was an entertaining safety net, something to up my score on Jeopardy or to educate my future children. My plan worked, somewhat. Again, despite my feminist upbringing, I attended BYU and got married my junior year. And that's when I put my education on the back burner. A few years later, shortly after my husband started law school, we got a divorce. I found myself two courses short of an English degree with no real ambitions or career path, and no husband, and no children. It was at this point that I really struggled to find my place at church. And to be honest, I'm still working out the details. I no longer felt entirely comfortable in a traditional family ward. There was so much emphasis on raising children, roles, and marriage. So I made the switch over to the young single adult wards. I now found humor in the fact that I thought the message would be any different. In the family ward, the message validated women for their marriages and families. In the singles ward, the message validated those who were progressing, as they call it in my ward, by getting engaged and leaving the ward. I have a hard time finding that kind of personal validation at church anymore. Sadly, I know that I'm not alone in this. For the first few years following my divorce, I mostly kept my distance from the church. I spent the first 25 years of my life following the correlated brochure with little success, so I decided to chart my own map for a while. It was my journey of discovery. I found out what it was like to base my decisions entirely by what I felt was right rather than by what I perceived the church expected me to do. For example, I married a returned missionary who had a current tuple recommend and attended BYU. Whatever could go wrong. Many of my decisions paved the way for disaster. I'll let you imagine an example. And some of my decisions brought me to new heights. All of my decisions helped me find myself. In short, I learned integrity, one of the young woman's values. That took me until I was an adult to start to understand. Of course, personal cartography is fascinating, but it turns out that it's exhausting, too. After being away for a while, I realized that I missed the gospel, the people, and the community. I missed having that map around, if only to use it as an occasional frame of reference. Late last year, I decided to come back, this time with a new perspective. A friend of mine told me once that as a card-holding member, she stays sane by compartmentalizing. That's how I survive as well. Some things I witness or hear at church go in the gospel pile, some go in the church pile, and some go in the where on earth did that come from pile. As I feel somewhat happy being back in the church, I still don't feel like I really belong. But then I'm not sure that I ever really felt like I did, even before my course correction. I have a hard time constantly being defined by something that I'm not. I don't fit the mold anymore. These days, I have an undergraduate degree, a career I'm excited about, though I'm unemployed at the moment, and future plans for graduate school. I'd like to get married again. I would love to have children. But I also know that I have very little control over those circumstances. And I feel like I am wasting my life constantly talking about imaginary spouses and pipe dream children at church. Ultimately, I am there to learn how to become a disciple of Christ. And I think at least I would be better served if the messages for women were more focused on love, compassion, personal growth, and service, rather than, as Julie Beck suggests, about learning how to be the best homemakers in the world. Thank you.
Hello. Yeah.
Okay, so
I did want to foreground what few remarks I have by saying the talk that inspired this session was not just a locus of confusion for, you know, the liberal intelligentsia of the urban community. It was the mothers across the board and non-mothers across the board. It was the conservatives as well as the liberals. I do think that Julie Beck was quite right when she said about motherhood, that is influence, that is power. Well, yes, certainly it is, although, as others have noted, it is not the only kind of influence nor the only kind of power which women should have or be encouraged to seek. But motherhood is such a locus of cultural pain because it is powerful. I'm sure if I asked you to think of a few examples of this, you could come up with them. I thought of a few. The cover of the New Yorker that arrived in my mail a few weeks ago has, I'm sure someone thought it was incredibly witty. It annoyed me. It had a picture of a couple walking past a big picture window, Barney's or someplace, and the husband or male partner is dragging the woman along behind him by the wrist, and he's going, rolling his eyes and looking so annoyed at his very window shoppy bride, who is staring at the picture window filled with babies. Because, you know, we all want many, many babies. They are an accoutrement now, an accessory. There's the T-shirt I once thought about buying from the National Organization for Women as a way to flout the questions I got regarding my childlessness. It says, oops, I forgot to have children. There's a very common bumper sticker, which I agree with, but I find a bit defensive. Every mother is a working mother. Well, amen, sister. Why would you think anything different? There's the whole political demographic of the soccer mom, which has a lot of connotations I won't even go towards. And then there's all those books we've been citing that Margaret found on Amazon. There's Get to Work, which is the one that's pretty popular in rhetoric right now. It's very useful, but it's also somewhat condescending in its take that a stay-at-home mother should not be taken seriously because she lives a life such as Huckleberry Finn. This shows a lack of understanding of stay-at-home mothers as well as of the text Huckleberry Finn. So, there's the book Don't Blame Mother, and the new Don't Blame Mother, titles which foreground exactly how much power we ascribe to mothers and why we have to cut them a little slack. Have you ever seen a more defensive title than Don't Blame Mother? There's the Motherhood Manifesto, which wisely locates childcare and mothering as feminist concerns and would advocate things like that. Really great idea of turning my local workhouse into a daycare. Very much on board with that. And now my computer's frozen. How very, very nice. There's When Mothers Work, Loving Our Children Without Sacrificing Ourselves, The Impossibility of Motherhood, Feminism, Individualism, and the Problem of Mothering, and then, of course, my favorite was the one Laura used extensively, The Bitch in the House, 26 Women Tell the Truth About Sex, Solitude, Work, Motherhood, and Marriage. I've read a lot of these books. I can't keep who says what straight, except for that Huckleberry Finn comment that I named my son Finn. But this isn't just a place of angst for Mormon women. It's a place of angst for women. It's a problem that it's a place of angst for women and not for people. It should be less just about angst for women and more about angst for the whole human family. My personal location and all that cultural angst, I guess, is what I can talk about, as did Emily a little. And it's ironic, because the few minutes I had to prepare what remarks I have, most of which I'm now aligning because other people already made the arguments, I sat up in my office feeling remarkably guilty because it was the first day of my nanny's job. I hired a part-time nanny, and she was in the house with my baby, and all I could think about was, I was such a terrible mother. Because I hired a nanny. I completely couldn't get over myself. I don't know why I can't stop yearning for 2 minutes of solitude while my body's being used as a jungle gym, or stop yearning for his damp little head on my shoulder when I'm away from him for 8 hours. I don't know why motherhood has to bifurcate my soul the way that it does, but I'm actually kind of okay with it doing that because it means I'm looking at my soul and paying attention to myself. It isn't an academic topic for me. Maybe that's why aligning most of what's on my computer doesn't bug me too much. I didn't arrive at motherhood via the sheer force of cultural inertia, like a lot of my Mormon friends did. I have been married 12 years, and I have a one-year-old child who is the result of the better part of a decade of trying to have a child of ungodly quantities of money flushed down the toilet and fertility treatments, subjecting my body to any number of hellish procedures, and then finally a weird Dickensian series of events that convinced me it is both my destiny and my choice to be a mother. God gave me the choice to choose that destiny, and we signed up and said, yes, please. We're awaiting now the adoption of our second child in October. But I had a free pass. I had a free pass to pursue my tenure track job and finish my still unfinished dissertation. Once people in the church surreptitiously found out why I didn't have kids, and I will tell you, they did surreptitiously want to know lots of really politely worded questions, trying to figure out if we were using birth control. But once people knew why we didn't have a child, they were very sympathetic, and I was given a real place in every ward I've ever been in. I was usually the gospel doctrine teacher and the religious study teacher. I felt like I was being incorporated into the structure, not the overreaching power structure, perhaps, but I had an identity apart from motherhood. And that was fine. What I didn't realize was that that identity was contingent on me remaining childless. I find that problematic. I cannot, for all the begging in my life, be calling in my current ward. But to illustrate this sort of occlusion of the different halves of a woman's soul, I was speaking with one of my undergraduate professors, who's a brilliant man. He speaks, I believe, 27 languages. It's very nauseating. And when he asked me about my family, he'd known my husband during our undergraduate years as well, and I mentioned that we were unable to have children. And the poor man, stumbling for, let's say, why I have such a dramatic announcement, he said, oh, well, maybe that's good, because you're a really good teacher, and now you can go teach at some place like Stanford or Princeton, and you couldn't have if you had eight kids, and you would have had eight kids, so maybe it's a blessing. And I smiled and went away. But this is not a stupid man. This is not a man who goes by things via sheer cultural inertia either, but to him, I could not be both a mother and those other things that I built my identity with. So that troubles me, because my child will maybe grow up thinking that his mom is less than she is. But that's not the only reason. The erasure of a significant portion of my identity due to the rhetoric and structure in the church bothers me, nor why I want to find kind and gentle ways to address those problems. It's what it does to my kid. I was holding him, I don't know, a couple months ago, and he's really cute. Really cute. And I waited so long for him, and I bought into all the fluffy Mary Cassatt light streaming down motherhood is glory and roses rhetoric, even though intellectually I knew it wasn't true because I lusted after that baby. And I looked at this beautiful fulfillment of all my dreams, and I said, oh honey, you're my world. Which at that moment was completely true. But see, that's a terrible thing to do to a child. You can't bear the weight of being someone else's world. So by erasing half of myself, or by allowing it to be erased, I don't just erase myself, I create my son as this megalomaniacal toddler. And most toddlers are megalomaniacal. And by necessity, you have to pay lots of attention to him. But if he grows up with that notion, well, all sorts of bad things will happen. I'm not sure what else I can say that hasn't been said. I do think when we say motherhood, destiny, or choice, we're creating a false dilemma. It doesn't have to be an either or. Destinies have a meaning unless you choose them. So that's something to throw out there. I also think, just a last half full moment, though the church's overreaching power structure doesn't have a commensurate role with priesthood, as Margaret and the others have spoken of, there is a skeleton architecture for building identity beyond motherhood in the church. I was very lucky. I was raised with that skeleton architecture. The young woman's values, which we should add that last couple paragraphs to, faith, divine nature, individual worth, knowledge, choice, accountability, good works, and integrity. Those are a lot better than what the general populace might offer an adolescent girl to build her identity upon. there is a more stringent focus on being educated for the sake of being educated rather than as a safety net, not as enough of a focus, but it's starting to change. There are ways you can utilize what's in the church to build an identity. I certainly think all of us on this panel managed to do that just fine. So I do want to recognize it's not all doom and gloom. For me, one remaining problem, though, is not so much the rhetoric on motherhood, it's the lack of commensurate rhetoric regarding fatherhood. Do I think that motherhood is one of the most important roles in eternity? Yeah, I think fatherhood is too. Raising children is a remarkably big endeavor. But can you honestly imagine any of those book titles with the word father inserted? Don't blame mother, or don't blame father. The new, don't blame father. Fathers get to work. The fatherhood manifesto. I like the bastard on the couch. That's a good one. Particularly when fathers work, loving our children without sacrificing ourselves. Nobody would ever write that book. I asked my husband the day after we hired the nanny, don't you feel guilty leaving for 16 hours a day? He works long shifts. Don't you feel guilty leaving the baby? Any female friend I asked that question of would have immediately become defensive or spilled her guts or vacillated between the two like I do. My husband just looked at me and said, what are you talking about? So others have suggested things in the structure of the church we can address as a people and the need to make our concerns heard. I would add to that list, we need a larger discussion about fatherhood. We need a larger discussion of how traditionally female attributes are integral into good fathering, not just that. Stuff about governance. And I wish I had a very powerful end, like Margaret did, but she kind of already did what I was going to say at the end. So I guess I'll just identity is not a simple thing. If you're in the academy, you've heard of the term of performative identity, and actually several people have address that issue, that we become what we perform. And in Mormon organizational structure, that seems to be true. It's even in the scriptures, if you are righteous, you'll gain a testimony. You become something as a result of action. But there is also, as Margaret mentioned, the idea of the great I am. If you're toggling between bits of your identity, and you're always torn between them, as women are asked to be, they're either asked to erase half of their identity or toggle. Fashion. You can't ever see what's in the middle. You can't see that peaceful spot where that's just pure being. And I'm afraid that it's not just the rhetoric that erases that. Sometimes it's the debate about the rhetoric that erases it as well. And I'm glad Margaret approached that. And ask questions.
It looks like we've got about 15 minutes for questions or comments, and I think what we are supposed to do is to come and form a line and speak into the mic. You may ask a question, you may make a comment, you may tell a story. We give you a choice here.
Okay, I'm the hog mic for a minute. I was offended that I was not on this panel because I think it was not completely balanced. I have tremendous respect for particularly you. You're so articulate in that, what was it? The PBS special. And so I just thought you were wonderful. And I wish that I were on this panel. If you had my bio on there, it would say Camille Agard, mother of five. I'm not a PhD candidate. I don't have a PhD, I'm not a candidate, and it's not in my future. I have a severely disabled 10-year-old down to that very scrawny little infant back in the stroller that's 4 months old. And I have four daughters. And I was raised in the church. I've always had a very confident sense of self, and I have attributed that to being raised in this church. I feel powerful. I don't need anything more than what I do, and I just want that mutual respect. I want to know that if I were in the Toscano family, that there wouldn't be little remarks behind doors about me home with my five children while my husband is the physician. And I feel so deeply respected when I hear words like, you know, motherhood is near to divinity. I believe that. I have pictures on my blog of, pardon me, me like with my hands up to my elbows and shit, vomit. And that is what I do, but I also see the divinity in it. It's tremendously difficult, and I did have a 5-year career, but this is a much harder game that I'm in, and I see the personal development that's coming along with it. And so I just don't want to be in a forum where I'm amongst, you know, Latter-day Saints and feel even undervalued. So let me, you know, show, but let me just, wait a minute, I heard words like, confined to my home. So the word confined. When you were concluding your talk, Margaret, you used words like, what was it, that we were going to perpetuate this mindlessness. Now that is what I'm talking about. And I am going to raise 4 girls, and hopefully to emulate me. And maybe they won't have any letters after their name. But it is not a mindlessness that I am teaching them. I'm teaching them something very powerful and very satisfying. And I just ask you to show the same respect for me. Thank you.
This was probably, I rewrote this talk 3 times. First thinking it was too strong, then too weak, then too strong, then too weak. And the reason I couldn't feel satisfied is that this is a really hard topic, that it's sort of like whatever you say, you're in a trap. And Camille, I want you to know that I do respect you. I mean, I happen to have a PhD. My sister Janice has 9 children. She doesn't have a PhD. I don't think you have to be educated. My daughter, my youngest daughter, is a hairdresser. And in my opinion, that's perfectly fine. Right now, she stays at home with her little daughter, the one I mentioned. I've been up to my elbows in shit and vomit because I had 4 daughters in 5 years. And I really do deeply respect it. And, you know, I'll rewrite this talk and I'll try to take out the language that seems to me, because I honestly don't feel that. To me, the problem is, though, that the rhetoric of motherhood in the church does feel like this militant thing that makes us feel like we can't, that there's only one path. And that's what I'm reacting to. I'm reacting to that system that makes me feel like that, you know, there's this just this one thing, and it isn't. I mean, you're right that motherhood is never just that one thing, but that's the feeling that we get all the time. So I deeply apologize, because in fact I do respect you a great deal, and I respect the women in the church a great deal. I do think we need to talk about these issues, and we need to work through and talk through, because if I don't talk to you, then I'll be blind and not see ways that I'm not including you. But I think the other thing is true too, that, you know, I don't think, I don't feel like Sister Beck's talk, and I, with all respect to her, because I think she said some good things. I mean, I agree with what Janet said about, I mean, motherhood is very, very important. But there's something about the rhetoric that is really creating problems that it doesn't have to, and that's what I'm upset about. So I'm sorry if I took too much time.
President Monson used to be my home teacher, and so I know him pretty well. He said recently that a man is the head of the family and a woman is its heart. What does the panel make of that?
May I make a brief statement? To me, that again is a kind of dichotomy that's damaging to all individuals. Every person needs both a head and a heart. Can you, using the symbolism, can you imagine a person without either a head or a heart?
But he's a prophet now. Speaking
well,
for God.
Well, my belief about what a man who is a prophet says is that we must always examine what they say and see if it makes sense. And if it makes sense, then we then go on and maybe ask for confirmation of the Spirit whether, you know, he was speaking as a prophet or not. But to me, it's always important to examine what is being said and to ask if, you know, if there's any evidence that it's true. So would anyone else
like to say? Try to speak loudly. That's not a metaphor, and it's duly problematic, thrice problematic.
Thank you. Language is inherently incapable of conveying actual truth. It's part of the fallen world. Then add to that another layer, a figurative language, a metaphor. And I'm a literature teacher. I value metaphor. I think metaphors create reality in this world, possibly in the next. But taking a metaphor, a bit of language, and trying to exact it in a very literal fashion on everyone's life is always going to be fraught with pain. It doesn't mean the metaphor isn't well-intentioned or doesn't have use, but if you try to fashion your entire life after the metaphor, you're going to get screwed, because as was just pointed out, when you take the metaphor out of the real world, you are out of the metaphorical world and apply it in the real world. If you don't have a head, you die. If you don't have a heart, you die. So I would say you have to realize the limits of the medium. I do hope, I call for an increase of the discussion of fatherhood. I think what would result from such a discussion, hopefully, would be the realization that fathers need to nurture, just as mothers do. Mothers need to lay down law, just as fathers do. That each person needs a head and a heart. But it's a metaphor.
I'm always scared to get up and ask questions, but I have a desperate situation that I need you wonderfully intelligent humans to help me answer. I have no children, and when I reveal to people that I'm making no plans to have children, I frequently get one of, or sometimes both of these responses. One is the immediate expression of pity, and then unending emotional rhetoric to convince me of the beauties of having children, and how if I just gave it a try, I would be convinced. And then the second, which I find much more heartbreaking, is that Mormon mothers, whom I really care for and love, feel like simply by my decision not to have children, I'm threatening them, and it ends in the defensiveness that you spoke of, Margaret. And I'm wondering, how can I respond to that? Should I just be quiet and try not to bring it up? What should I do in this situation?
Tell them you're infertile. Yeah, they call it all sales line.
My husband used to tell people that we were perfecting our technique first, and that made them never, ever ask. Or another one, and this is before we knew that we were barren, he would tear up. And my husband's not at the motor, so people always thought it. And he's like, the motor just hasn't seen fit to bless this with a child. I think if you're dealing with somebody who really can't handle it and is going to become defensive, truth is a great thing, but you don't have to share all truth at all times. Your question is big, and I would love to talk with you about it afterwards. But I don't think you need... You have no moral obligation to share your reasons with those people. You don't have to speak to the subject if you don't want to. And if you don't speak to the subject and they choose to be offended, if they were going to choose to be offended anyway by me feeling threatened by your choice, you might as well not lay your heart on the line first. I
On the What Women Know website, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but there were two things in the document, if you're familiar with it, that were most troublesome or most talked about, and one was the reference to the stripling warriors, and the other that was most controversial was, are you encouraging women not to have children? Are you saying that it's a choice? So your experience your experience bears out. It's not uncommon.
but I don't know what to do about it. I mean, you can if you want to be activist about it, then you suffer the consequences of your activism. I would encourage you not to speak about it.
But you're not. You know very guilty for how someone feels about it.
So. Yeah. Do you feel? I mean, is it?
I don't consider myself deeply guilty. Number one, it's just an irritating situation. Number two, I mean, I don't want to be making people feel worthless because I've chosen something different.
The problem is, all we're talking about here, all that you're talking about is making personal choices. And if other people are uncomfortable with your personal choices, it's their problem.
So
we're trying to make room for choice for women.
Our time is up, but I want everyone who is in line to speak to have an opportunity. So we will go over time. And
I almost didn't come to this panel because I thought, I haven't been to church as a believing Mormon in 19 years. I'm the most fabulous homemaker there is. Of course, the home I make is for myself alone, but God, I can knit like nobody's business. And what made me decide to come has to do with what you said. The President Swanson is the prophet. He's not my prophet, but he claims to be. And this business that you're talking about, it's not just for Mormon women. It's supposedly for all women. I don't buy into this shit anymore, but it still applies to me. Now, what do we do about the fact that the leading cause of death for pregnant women in the United States is being murdered by the father of their child? What do we do about rape camps in Bosnia where women are intentionally impregnated with fetuses they don't want to carry as part of ethnic cleansing? What do we do about the fact that women in Africa, when they get pregnant at 12, are then sentenced to a life of poverty? What do we do about the worldwide implications of motherhood for all women, even women who have never heard of this church? What do we do about the political status of women throughout the whole world, regardless of what it means in the next life?
Thank you very much.
Those are really good questions, Holly, and they would take another session to respond to, I'm sure. I wanted to say that my decision to come up here was prompted by Camille. Is she still here? Is Camille still here? Okay. All right. Well, I'll say it anyway. I got married when I was 19 years old, and I had four kids, and then I went back to school and got a degree, and then I went to law school and became a lawyer. And I can tell you that, for certain, that I was no smarter when I graduated from law school or when I practiced law than I was when I was a stay-at-home mom. But I can also tell you that I sure got a lot more respect at church after I was a lawyer. And it wasn't that, all of the rhetoric that the church gives about motherhood never felt to me like validation. It always felt to me like a sob thrown to women to compensate them for the fact of their second-class status in the church. And for all of the lip service the church gives to validating motherhood, the fact is, the women they really have respect for are the women who accomplish something professionally. And that's just an unfortunate fact of how I perceive Mormon life to be.
Thank you, Nadine. And speak to each of the women. You can get the tape. You can get the tape from Sunstone, and I'm sure that the women would be happy to provide you with copies of their talk.
Well, I don't know. But